All right, welcome back to the Mind Mate podcast, guys. Hey, I was away this weekend. I was down, well, down, when I say down, I'm down. So I was up in towards Mount Buller for everyone that lives in the Victorian area in Australia. And it's just so good to get away, get out of your own routine, get out of your own head and audit yourself, you know, audit your life, have a think about what you're doing. The most important thing we can do, and I think this is what counseling therapy does, talk therapy, is that it gives you a chance to have an open, honest conversation with someone. So you're taken out of your own head and you are confronted with yourself to the degree that the counselor is competent, you know, and is able to guide you as you unpack layers of your own awareness. And what camping with, you know, I was camping with mates, and what that did for me was it was a good chance for me to reflect upon my own life, have a look at my areas of weakness and insufficiency, my areas of strength and competence, and have a think about how I want to go at, you know, rectifying certain issues, getting better at issues. Like, am I putting too much time and attention into my writing? Am I not putting enough time and attention into my business? You know, things like this. Am I doing things unnecessarily from a procrastinatory perspective? You know, all this sort of stuff. If you can find some way to frequently get out of your own head, whether that's getting out, you know, from a physical perspective and camping, sitting in silence, having an honest conversation with someone, unpacking layers of awareness, I guarantee you it will change your life. If you cultivate that and add fuel to that fire over weeks and months, you will come to know yourself better than you ever have before. Now, whether that's counseling, whether that's camping, whatever you need to do, you must re-navigate and reflect upon the internal compass that is you. And that is a brilliant segue to this episode of the podcast with my main man, Chris, who I think is a four-time guest now of the show, potentially three-time, could be four-time. I want to say four-time. My ego wants to say four-time. We just shirt the shit. We went right into it, and we spoke about all different sorts of things from, you know, mythical symbology to psychology to unpacking layers of awareness to getting out of your comfort zone and embracing fear, because beyond fear is learning and growth. So I really hope you enjoyed this episode, guys. And look, this is a crazy time for us all. Please be selfish so that you can be selfless. Sit in silence. Write the book you've always wanted to. Spend time doing what you need to do to fulfill yourself. This is ultimately your life, and you must live in accordance with that truth. I love you all, guys. Talk soon.
Who starts then? Who starts? This is coming out on both of our podcasts. Good to see you, Tommy. It's we were just talking. It's been, what, 14, 15 months since we had a decent sit down and a chat.
I know. It's crazy, man. I know. We were just talking about that. I think, like I said, I had a hell of a lot more hair. So I'm going the opposite way.
Yeah. And I think we kick things off because it had been a while since our chat prior to that as well. Like, I think it had been 6 months or a year.
Yeah.
It never feels like that long when we connect and we talk. But I think, like, we had a baby. You had a book.
You and I did. We did have a baby.
Yeah, we did. We did. It was an interesting looking one.
It was. I don't know how we managed it, man. We're biologically very, very unprepared, but we got there.
Yes. Yeah. That's true. And you had a book that had just come out as well.
Yes, that's right. Yes. It. What was that? That was. Well, I think it had officially come out a couple of months prior to that, but. Yeah.
So had the baby.
No, sorry. the book actually came out with the baby. So
yeah, the baby's holding the book.
Yeah, I was actually reading it.
Yeah, he's a smart baby.
Mate, he is. Takes after his old man.
yeah. Well, might take after his mother actually. Mate, so you're in the midst of writing another book, aren't you?
I'm in the midst of writing three.
Three. All right. Yeah. So good.
Trying not to. I didn't mean to, but I'm pretty close. I'm about I'd say 2 weeks off finishing the third draft of my second, which is just a huge backbreaker, because this draft has just taken me coming up to a year, I think. Do you know what? I actually think I was writing this draft, or I'd just begun writing this draft when we'd done our previous podcast. So it's longer than a year. So
yeah,
this is a big one.
Shit, yeah, mate. Yeah. So what's this one all about?
Yeah, well, it's I tried to go into the deepest possible roots I could of identity, because it's so malleable. And my first book was called Yes, I'm Fine, Just Tired. This one's called Yes, I'm Fine, Just Busy. The idea being there that the busier we are, the less we can really see the truth. And then the next question is, what is the truth? The third book I'm writing, so the third and the one I'm writing now were conjoined, were kind of juxtaposed, because, the third one really, really just rode the wave of the second one I'm talking about now. But I made it a third one because it was just too big. Mm. So that one's actually going to be called Yes, I'm Fine, Just Thinking. So it's a really fun way to have those, I suppose.
And is that the one that you just kind of unpack the truth and give us all of the answers?
Yeah. Well, it's a bit different again, I suppose. So the one I'm writing now is about identity and how it's malleable and how we can actually analyze and see that across multiple levels of analysis. So we have a look at what identity is from the evolutionary perspective, from a more spiritual, perhaps, I suppose, and then also kind of a psychoanalytic perspective. The third book, Yes, I'm Fine, Just Thinking, is actually how to integrate awareness, because this is something that's consistently come up for me in my counseling sessions. Oftentimes we think that going to speak to a therapist or perhaps, journaling or meditating, all these great tools that cultivate self-awareness, that they're actually leading to change in and of themselves, and they are to a degree, but I really wanted to make the necessary, I felt, distinction between what awareness is and then what integration is. So it's all well and good for someone to speak to a counselor or speak to a therapist, but how do we actually take that and then apply that to our lives? So I suppose what I wanted to do in this book was talk about all the things I was writing about, really help people unpack layers of awareness, and then how they could actually integrate that and make those changes. So I thought it would be a good book by itself. That's why I kind of switched it around.
Mm. Awesome, man. And I mean, yeah, awareness, the more I think about it and kind of the probably the more aware I become of myself, like I realize it's just the first step, basically. Like you can, as you said, you can go to a counselor, or to use another analogy, you can come and see me as a physiotherapist. Absolutely. With an injury, and yeah, I can point out to you what's wrong, and I can tell you the stuff that you need to go away and do.
Yes.
But if you don't do it,
that's exactly right.
You'll probably get better, because time is a great healer. But
you just lose a lot of money.
Yeah. You'll limp around for a while anyway.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. I think that's a much more tangible example as well. It's just and it's funny, I don't even know. My own experience, I always thought that speaking to a psychologist was doing the work, and that was actually just the painful stuff. This is essentially why you're fucked, and now here's what to do about it.
Yeah, and I think that's probably something that you might get into in the current book that you're writing as well, is that like going and talking to people feels like it's the work, but it's actually just kind of busyness. Or it's the part before the work that you need to put in.
It's so true. And, I also don't want to kind of disregard or, invalidate people's experience when they're going to speak to someone, because like you said, man, it is challenging. And to actually take that first step and say to yourself effectively, I actually don't have all the answers here. I need someone to help me is doing something, which is massive, but it's not doing everything. And I think that's such an important position to take, so that we don't feel like job's done, and you and I both obviously agree with this, that the job's never done. You can't press pause on life until you obviously pass away. So I think just knowing those things, and you know, I tried to have a bit of fun with the book as well. You know, talking about dream analysis and, you know, doing all the things that I'm into as well. So
yeah
it's not just hopefully it's not boring.
And a bit of classic Tom Ahern humor as well, I'm sure.
Yeah, there's a bit of that in there. Yeah, a couple of penis gags.
Yeah, I thought there'd be a couple of dick jokes in there, eh?
For sure.
Yeah. Like, really fascinated. Like, you've been thinking a lot about kind of identity and how it's malleable. Like, what's changed in your view of your own identity maybe over the last 18 months since you've been jumping into this?
Yeah, well, I didn't... You know, the reason I write my books isn't necessarily, you know, to be known as an author or anything. It's because I really want to find out these answers for myself. So that, I suppose they really come from a very selfish perspective initially. But I started writing this book because I'd lost my own identity. You know, I didn't know who I was, and it was really scary. I was drowning in the waters of the unconscious because I had nothing to cling on to. There was no ego. You know, sailing a ship or anything. I had no direction. And that kind of happened when I stopped playing football, had found CrossFit, but it felt kind of like the shell of who I was with football. I felt so linked to football. And then when I hurt my knee moving overseas, and I realized that athlete and Tom were no longer, you know, linked, I really... Because I just wanted to be an athlete my whole life, you know.
Mm.
And then when my knee injury kind of got the better of me, I really started to have to think about, well, you know, this probably isn't possible, at least in the foreseeable future. And I also want to go traveling, and I fell in love at the same time, and, you know, all these sorts of things. So that wasn't – I say it now, you know, and it sounds so simple, but it was very scary for a good couple of years there because I just didn't know who I was. I thought athlete was me, you know. So I suppose the reason why I wanted to study this kind of stuff, which really is depth psychology, you know, getting to the root of who someone is, was very important to me because I felt like I was drowning, you know. And it's different when, you know, some of the stuff I talk about in the book is, you know, the difference between like consciously deciding to take something on that is inevitably going to change your identity, like, you know, I can only guess that for you, for example, dude, like becoming a father, obviously it's a massive decision.
Yeah.
It's going to change your identity. There's going to be like a pre child and a post child experience in life, but you're also looking forward to it, not discounting how bloody challenging it would be, but you had that, like, I'm ready to make this step, I suppose. I don't know. Did you feel that?
Yeah, probably yes and no. And actually, I think I felt like a lot of other guys out there who are like, yeah, I can probably be a dad.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure. Yeah. I mean, I think like as males, we probably lack the same biological driver as females who say, yeah, I'm ready to be a mum.
Yeah.
And there's that biological sort of stuff that's going on for them. But like everyone that I talked to about it was like, you're never ready.
Mm.
Like you're never ready before they arrive. And then they're here, and
yeah,
you just have to do it. But I think as well, like as you said, it massively changes your identity as well, and it changes your perspective. And like in essence, I'm still the same person that I was before Connor arrived. But I think like it's changed my perspective on a lot of things. It's changed my priorities on a lot of things. And I don't know if this is kind of just natural evolution for me as well, or if it's accelerated it, but it's, I think it's probably accelerated, but it's made me much more aware and in touch of my emotions and what's driving them too.
Mm. What do you mean by that? Like, how does it change your emotion?
So, like, I mean, we're typical Kiwi and Aussie guys.
Oh, yeah.
No, slightly stoic. Probably weren't particularly in touch with our emotions when we were younger. I think it's probably just heightened them a little bit. Like, you'd kind of see something touching on the internet. You're like, oh, not in a creepy way, but in like a heartfelt, touching sort of video before you become a dad. And you're like, oh, yes, it's nice. That's nice.
That.
But then afterwards you're like, oh shit, that's kind of bringing a tear to my eye. And like today as well, is like I was sitting down, I was having a meeting at work, and like here in New Zealand, we've basically just come out of lockdown and we're starting to get back into things. So we had to kind of take all of our services and deliver them virtually and work virtually as a team when we'd previously been in the same office space. And like my guys, my team came together ridiculously well. And I was talking to them about stuff today, and I just said, look, I'm just so proud of you guys for how you came together and the work that you put in and how we supported each other through this period of time. And I started to get a bit choked up about it.
Yeah.
And I was just like, I think it's just kind of experiencing emotions on a slightly more heightened level. I think, and I don't know, maybe just feeling them a little bit more deeply.
Just kind of cracks you open a bit.
Yeah, it does. It does. And I think you give less of a fuck about showing them to people as well, as like, actually, what am I holding the stuff back for? Like this, there's this tiny little baby that blows your mind with doing new stuff every day and is just, yeah, like it's a miracle of life, the miracle of life. But, all of a sudden you're like, well, actually, who cares if I have a bit of a cry in front of people? It doesn't matter.
Man, I don't – my other half and I were trying to think this through, where, like, when did this whole idea that emotions are weak or whatever it is, where did that come from? Like, I tried to backtrack it to perhaps like the First World War, where, you know, blokes were getting either honourable or dishonourable, you know, discharges and things, because I suppose like psychological injuries, you know, weren't really something that you could see. But what's so interesting to me is like how we put these labels on what's weak and what's not. But, you know, when you learn a bit more about trauma therapy as an example, seeing what the body necessarily has to do to allow the hormones and all that sort of stuff to move through the body so they can actually get back. Now we have this ability to decide how we want to act. You know, when we suppress our emotions because it's for whatever reason, some kind of label's been put on them, it can literally take years off our lives. And I just don't know where that came from, where like how emotions are weak, because we've had them for far longer than 200 million years. It's so strange to me. I don't know.
Yeah. Where did you get back to in looking at that stuff?
Well, yeah, I mean, I got as far back as 210 million years with the development of the mammalian.
Quite a while.
Really. Yeah. So, yeah. You know, what, ballpark figure?
Yeah.
I got a while there. But even to go even further back with, you know, something that Jordan Peterson talks about with lobsters being 350 million years old, this nervous system, you know, structure, the ability for us to be aware of where we stand in social hierarchies and things. It's so old, and yet we're only now just starting to have a conversation around, you know, it's okay to not be okay and uncomfortable is okay, you know, the words of the great man by yourself. But I really don't know. I really don't know.
Yeah, like it's fascinating. You look at some of the kind of the older societies that we have, and like I'm just spitballing here. I haven't looked at them nearly as closely as you. But like, take for example Stoicism as well. Stoicism and being Stoic gets quite a bad rap at the moment, and because people don't really understand it, it's rather than kind of repressing your emotions, the Stoics looked at them more deeply and tried to understand them, and then kind of made decisions based off off that through the perspective that they took on them, as opposed to having an emotion, repressing it, and just getting on with shit.
Yeah, exactly. And you're exactly right. And to think that, I think we've done a brilliant job in the last 500 years of overvaluing one part of the brain that happens to be the youngest part of the brain. You know, we're very cognitive, we're very objective, you know, but most of all, actually, of what's driven us to the 21st century is how to act, emotions, it's fulfillment, it's getting to a pleasure, you know, a pleasurable place from a painful place. It's these emotions that are driving our behavior. Even the word emotion is energy in motion. It's what are we doing, as opposed to, you know, and this is obviously getting into the field of morality, that you can't derive an ought from an is. We just don't look at the world as a place of things. You know, we look at our place in the world and how we should do, and all the world's a stage. And, you know, we've just become very good at neglecting some of what I would describe as the very ancient wisdom that's inherent in the body.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting kind of where we, like, thinking, looking back where we lost our way on that. Did you look at the Industrial Revolution much in terms of kind of what was happening around that time too?
Yeah, I think it, I think it came from as early as Descartes, you know.
Yeah.
I really think that's when it came. And don't get me wrong, I think the objective worldview is very important. We wouldn't be friends without science.
We've not at all.
Met.
Yeah.
You're like one of my best mates, podcasting mates.
It's strange kind of who I know virtually, right, that I've never met in person. Exactly. But can sit down and have a yarn like this.
Yeah, exactly. It would probably be like the most awkward thing in real life.
Do we shake hands, or is that inappropriate now?
Yeah, exactly. I know. No, so I think maybe just looking back into how we got to where we are today, not throwing out all the baby with the bathwater, the scientific perspective has been great, but now we're all lost and existential and, you know, nihilistic. And I think, and these aren't my ideas, this is just some ideas that I took from other people that worked in my own experience. But looking back to what got us here with, you know, the subjectivity, and if we can mold those two now, which I think is what the world's doing, I suppose. I think everyone's starting to think about, you know, being a bit more honest and, you know, understanding themselves, being okay with who they are and, you know, asking questions. And, well, I hope so anyway. I'm biased because I see that all the time, but I don't know.
Yeah, and I think that's something that I definitely see more of as well, because you're 26, eh, Tom?
27,
sorry, mate, sorry.
Come on, mate.
Come on, wiser than I thought. But, yeah, I mean, like, I'm nine years older than you. So I think I probably had a chance to see that evolution a little bit more. But I think, again, you're right in that because of the stuff that we do and because of the way that we think, we move in certain circles, and the circles that we move in probably are the ones that we see this stuff happening more often. And I mean, the Facebook algorithm will feed us that shit as well. So yeah. Like, I think there's definitely more of it happening, whether it's kind of as much as we think it is or not. I don't know. I don't get millions of downloads on my podcasts. So maybe it's not that many people.
just you and myself, mate.
Yeah. And mum.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
Yeah.
For sure. And how do you, I mean, do you see that kind of playing out? Because when I think of physiotherapy as well, because I'm so biased, I can't help but think about the psychosomatic perspective on body injuries as well and all that sort of stuff. I mean, how much of your role is counsellor as well?
I've been having a few conversations like this recently, actually. And I think, like, when you start out in any sort of health profession, it is very much I'm going to go off all of the theory that I've just learned. It's definitely biomechanical, or it's there's a problem with this system. But like I've been a physio now for, I don't know, 13 or 14 years. Yeah. And I work a lot with people who have chronic pain or complex injury. And I think like it's probably 20 to 25% is the actual injury itself. Yeah. Like I said, that stuff mostly gets better with time. And 80% of it is the psychological stuff. And like, so I kind of think about it like, how can I make this person, help this person be more resilient to navigate the challenge that they're in at the moment? If I give them the right exercises to do, then they're going to get better. And the right exercises aren't ones that are particularly complex. Like every now and then you get something cool come in and you're like, oh, I'm going to have to think hard on this one.
Yeah.
But it is more of kind of managing expectations and creating some safety for people, creating a sense of hope that they can work towards, but then also kind of progressively managing their expectations as they work through a process as well, because you can't go too fast, because then actually things get stirred up and people don't feel safe and they kind of start to withdraw. But you don't want to go too slowly either, because then that just kind of enhances people's fear if you're holding them back. So it's a, it's an interesting balancing act. And I think like the vast majority of it is like, how do I manage the kind of the mindset or the psychology of this person, as opposed to how do I purely manage this injury? I'm biased though. I'm very biased. You talk to other physios and they'll be like, 90%, it's the injury.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And it's so hard to kind of take ourselves out of our own perspectives. But dude, I agree with you. And, you know, I think what you're talking about there is so congruent with the ideas of Csikszentmihalyi. So he wrote, you know, about flow, that idea that to really find your flow when time adapts to your experience. It's a brilliant quote. You know, that idea that we want to see progress. You know, what we're doing isn't overly challenging, so it's not anxiety provoking, but it's also not boring. You know, that idea that we can, and then even further to abstract out of that, it's that idea that we are moving from a painful place to a better future. We're always in that state, which is so interesting, because it's like, and you know, to my point before, we've been getting very good at understanding the objective world. This is a candle. This is a computer. That is Saturn. That is Mars. And we've really lost that. Well, how do we live in this world? You know, what's the subjectivity? What better future am I moving to? Why is it necessary for me to overcome this injury? Who am I? Who do I want to be? So I suppose, probably why you and I connect, mates, you know, irrespective of the industry, there is that idea based upon your psychology and my psychology of how do we integrate this kind of experience into our lives and into our clients' lives.
Yeah. And it's fascinating. And like I've been running a few workshops and doing a little bit of coaching with people at the moment, kind of outside of the physio stuff, around kind of load management. So it's the, how am I managing the loads in my life at the moment? Like having physical rehab principles, but applying that kind of across the spectrum and using the psychology of that. And I don't know if you're familiar with the Yerkes-Dodson curve or the Yerkes-Dodson law.
No.
So it's performance versus arousal level.
Oh yes.
Yeah. So it's the you start off low. Yeah. You start off low and then you hit peak and then you come back down. And I think like most people that I have talked to, and obviously like I move in health circles, so I've done this with a lot of health professionals who have been basically working throughout, but they're kind of sliding down that side of the curve towards overwhelm, just because there's so much load going on them at the moment. I've run a few others with actually some CrossFit gyms, and some of the members there haven't had that much to do over this period of time. So they're sitting on the other side. They're sitting down in that, like, that comfort zone. And I kind of break that curve up actually into three different facets. Is you've got the comfort zone on that lower end of the load, and then you've got your performance zone or your stretch zone in your middle, and then that sort of zone of overwhelm as well. And it's kind of like when you're starting to head down into the wards, that overwhelm zone, that's almost like you've got an injury. So it's like, how do I come back up out of that, and how do I get back to that peak performance, because I've overloaded myself and injured myself, for want of a better word. A lot of people I find can do that just with a little bit of load manipulation in the time, and can kind of swing back towards peak performance. And it's like, I don't think it's probably, there's more work that people need to do after that, but it's really interesting kind of how you can manipulate the loading on someone just by changing a few small things to take the pressure off, so that they can start to slide back and they can create a little bit more space, then to maybe do some more of that long-term work.
Yeah. I mean, I think what you just said there goes for every industry. You know, I really think we all want to feel like the work we're doing is challenging and therefore meaningful, but it's also, you know, not chaotic, and, you know, we are on top of it. Like, it's so hard. And, you know, I think about balance, right? This idea that we should have a little bit of this and a little bit of this and a little bit of this. And there's such a static way to look at life. Everyone's trying to find their balance, you know, which is essentially the same way of saying trying to get to this place where, you know, everything is good. So it's like, I'm doing all the right things. But, we're future-oriented. You know, you can't get out of that inevitable truth. We're always moving from point A to point B up until we die. And I think balance is very much congruent with what you said about the you and about what Tuksep Mahai talks about with flow. Balance is that ability to mediate tasks that are too challenging and not challenging enough, so that we're simultaneously, so we're seeing progress and we feel like we're on top of things, you know?
And I think that's something that you constantly need to tweak as well, is that, and balance, I think, is balance to me is, sounds like a static concept that people are searching for. It's like, all right, if I do this and this and this and this, then I'm in balance, it's fine. Yeah. And it's really regimented. And then if you don't do that, then you get pissed off at yourself and wind yourself out. But I think that, like, we're pretty fluid beings as humans as well, and what is in balance for us, what might be in balance for us one day, the next day is not going to be in balance because we haven't had a great sleep, because our 2-year-old's woken up 3 times overnight, or you've got a cold or a flu or something like that, or I don't know. The dogs crapped on the carpet or something. Something like that. And
I crapped on the carpet.
Yeah, and then the dog ate it and then threw it up.
And then I ate it and threw it up.
Yeah. And then your partner started yelling at you for all of that.
Yeah. But then obviously liked at the same time, couldn't save money and, you know.
Yeah. But yeah, that balance of stuff changes depending on our environment, and it can be kind of, it's a moving target, I guess.
Yeah, it's always a moving target, isn't it? Yeah, and even just your own laziness and procrastination. Like I'm like that all the time at the moment. Like I'll set my alarm for 7. I wake up, it's like 8:30. Like, oh right, well that just throws the schedule out.
Yeah,
and sometimes I'll wake up at 4:30 or 5, and I'm like, oh okay. Well then that throws the schedule out too, but I have to readjust and. I don't know, it's just this funny, yeah, I'm just as bad as the next guy for giving out advice, you know, that I think is really helpful. And what I'm saying here is I'm just the biggest part of the problem, since that we live now in this world where we can access information all the time, and the information is marketed as such that it's the only thing you need to know, and that'll fix your life, you know. But it's just impossible, A, because, you know, we know our own lives better than anyone, and B, you're never going to have the same day. So that piece of advice might work perfectly for me today. Then tomorrow, it's just like, oh, well, what I read 10 years ago in a psychology book is actually what applies to me now.
You know, yeah.
Finding this constant, it's a very funny world we live in this kind of self-development boom, you know?
Yeah, and I think the more that I start, that I ask questions, and kind of the more that I live life, the more that I realize that there isn't just one right answer for things. And I think, like, it's a cliche, but the toolbox analogy is fantastic. Yeah. Is that you have a range of tools at your disposal. I think someone referred to it as an a la carte menu the other day, is that you've got these options there that you can pick and choose from and use on a certain day, and what works for you some days isn't going to work for you other days. Like, I'm sure that you do a little bit of meditation.
I haven't
from time to time, but like some days if you're meditating, like some days you're like, sweet, down into it, golden. Other days you're like, I just can't sit here and do this. I need to go out for a run.
Yes.
And utilizing those tools to have a similar effect, I think is really important. And yeah, and then I think it comes back to that concept of awareness of yourself as well, is what's the awareness that I have of what's going on for me at the moment? And then what tools do I have at my disposal that I can then use to action?
It's so true. Yeah. You know, everything can be a tool. You know, even I've found that even putting the fire on, you know, like burning the wood and just looking at the wood is really lovely, or playing with the dogs. And I think you're totally right, mate. You can't be a master of the tool unless you've tried it, you've given it a go. And you know, I think there are moments where, you know, we'll just be staring at our computer screen for hours. You're like, I think I need some connection. And then you go and talk to your spouse, or you call your parents, or whatever you need to do. So that's a brilliant tool, you know. And I think the idea behind tool as well, which I think is a really important one, is that the analogy of tool only works if you're building a house. So everything that you're doing has to be for a particular reason. You know, and I heard Alan Watts talking about this on a lecture, whenever it was recorded 40, 50 years ago. And he said, you know, people are always asking me, is it necessary? Is it necessary to meditate? Is it necessary to do all these things? And he said, well, it depends on what you're doing. Like, where do you want to go? His analogy was, if you're driving to New York, it's necessary to take the highway. So what are you doing in your life that actually renders meditation worthwhile and necessary? Because, you know, I mean, and that depends on the frequency and the intensity as well. You know, if you want to be a monk, you're probably going to have to meditate a hell of a lot more than you and I. If you and I are just trying to, you know, turn the dial on the
chill the fuck out.
Chill the fuck out. Probably a better way of saying it.
Yeah.
If that's what we're trying to do, then maybe 15 minutes will work for us, you know. I mean, everything comes down to ultimately what you're doing. You know, what is your point B? And, you know, on a slight tangent, I'm finding that to be the biggest thing coming up, second to relationships in the counseling world, is that people don't have a point B. They don't have an aim. You know, they're just uncertain. And people use a whole different array of words for this. Suicidal, depressed, anxious, lost, angry, you know, and however many times it's just, and not for everyone, people have their own, you know, separate issues and things, but I'd say over 60-70%, it's, I don't have a point P, I don't have a reason to be getting out of bed, or they do, but they're just perhaps not consciously aware of what they're doing. So I think I've become very interested in that point B idea.
Yeah, I think that's a really important one for people, and like when you're, I'm sure that you find as well that you get better results with people who have a point B.
Well, there's a reason.
Yeah, that makes them more. Yeah, that makes them more resilient. That makes them kind of want to get better. And I think, like, from a physical perspective, you ask people like, what do you want to get back to? Like, do you play any sport, or do you go running, or what's your work? And your heart always sinks a little bit when they say, oh, no, nothing.
I know. Like, what are we doing then?
How am I going to take you through this process? It's going to be it'll be an interesting one. And I think, like, you can, it's easy to take, well, no, not easy. It's, you can take people part of the way through that process because you're taking them away from pain, but you can't take people through that whole process. Because, like, if you think of it kind of from a pain to pleasure continuum, like when people get far enough away from pain, they don't notice it anymore. But then they stop and they're only halfway there.
Brilliant point.
Whereas if you can kind of generate, maybe, I don't know if I like the word pleasure, because it sounds kind of in the moment, maybe pain to purpose as a continuum. It's a, again, kind of cliched word, but you take people away from the pain far enough and then they just kind of sit there. And if they're not moving towards purpose, then, like, for you, probably not so much in a physical sense, is that they start to slide back towards pain because they're not continuing to move that way.
Yeah, dude, I resonate so much with what you just said. And I think, you know, one of the tough challenges about psychology is that, you know, I'm big on journaling, because pain and pleasure, or pain and purpose, that, geez, that's a tongue from stuff, pain and purpose, they're very intangible. You know, people come to you and they say, oh, I'm depressed, you know, or I'm lost. It's like, okay, well, what does that look like? But when you go to a physio, it's like, oh, I can't extend my knee or something like that. It's
like, I can measure that shit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things I try to do is measure people's pain from a psychological perspective based upon comparing them with where they'd like to be, or perhaps who they used to be when they were fulfilled, you know. And we just journal. We're just like, what's a typical day in your life like? And it can be very confronting to people because, you know, when we go back and read that, it's filled with things that are tough for them to read. Oh, I'm addicted to porn or alcohol, or, you know, I always sleep in, or I'm, you know, I lie a lot, or all these things. And when you really see that, it's just like, oh, damn, like, no wonder I'm in pain, you know. It's very easy to kind of avoid that truth. But I think your point about getting like 50% away from the pain and then recoiling back into that is so true, even in my area, because we don't feel pain psychologically anymore. We can just numb it all the fucking time, all the fucking time. And that inability to feel pain as one of the two most fundamental motivators for human behavior, if you just take one of them away, no wonder everyone's fucking depressed and existential, because we don't have a major framework. It's gone, you know?
Yeah. And one of my previous podcast guests as well kind of used something, or said something, that reminds me of that, is that the body always whispers before it screams. But I think, as you say, we're so guilty of numbing that small pain that starts to whisper to us, say, hey, you probably want to check this out. Like, something's a bit off here. Like, you want to have a look at that. But then you numb it with something. You're like, no, I'll go and watch some porn and drink a slab or something like that.
That's a great 2 minutes.
Yeah. And then I feel all right again. but And then all of a sudden, because you can numb it, you hit a tipping point where all of a sudden that pain becomes too much, and then you can't numb it with things anymore.
Yeah. It's just, it's crazy, that idea. I was walking Archie, one of our dogs, and he's just in that phase. He's just so young, and he's just in that phase where everything's novel and new, and he can't stop running, and he pulls on the leash all the time. And normally I would listen to a podcast whilst walking him, and I'll discipline him and I'll train him and I'll give him to sit and all this stuff, but it's quite tolerable because I'm interested in what I'm listening to. But a couple of days ago, it was yesterday actually, I just didn't have my phone because my partner and I had planned to walk together. Halfway through the walk, we were like, okay, this isn't going to work. They're just shocking when you walk them both together. So I walked him home, and dude, I hated it by the end of it. Like, I was literally fantasizing about punching him, beating him up, because I was so angry and frustrated. And I just had to sit down, and I was just like, wow, this is a pain and an anger that I've just been completely unconscious of, because I've been tuning out and listening to my podcast. Now, what was interesting for me was like, okay, the podcast has actually served as a relatively practical distraction, because I can still do my job with the dog and not actually want to beat him to a pulp, because I actually quite love him. But it was so interesting for me to actually really feel that, because I didn't have a choice.
Yeah, that is fascinating as well. Like, looking back on that, have you been able to kind of figure out what was behind it, or flip your perspective on it at all?
Yeah. I have. I was just, here's one of them now. I think I'm naturally a selfish person, and I really struggle when I can't at least get something out of something that I'm doing, which is a very humbling thing to say, I suppose, because I don't particularly like that about myself, and it's a skill I'm trying to develop.
Yeah.
More selfless, I suppose. But I think changing that perspective and being like, okay, this is Archie's time. It's not my time.
Yeah. Can I posit something to you though, Tom?
Mate,
like
please.
That maybe you could get out of this. So I recently finished reading Awareness by Anthony DeMello.
Oh,
I don't know if you've come across that, but it's pretty interesting. And one of the things that he was talking about in there is just kind of our ability to name things is fantastic, but it's also detrimental to us because we stop looking at the uniqueness in life. Like, you call something a tree and you're like, you have this mental picture of it that comes up, but actually this tree is not that tree and it's not that tree. So could you work on the walks, look at seeing the world a little bit like Archie, and, or as I do, like Connor, who's two, who is also into this stuff.
Yes.
And seeing the uniqueness of every different thing. So that's something that I've been trying to work on a little bit over the last couple of weeks. And you're like, shit, the way that the light is hitting that tree today is really, really cool. Or the birds that are flying around in it. And actually they're the same bird, or they're the same species of bird, but they look quite different once you start to look at them as individual things. And it just, I always find it creates a little bit more of a sense of wonder about the world. And like, to go back to that tool analogy as well, like, it's a tool to use, but also to extend the metaphor further, when you start using a tool, you're pretty shit at it. Like, the nails that you hammer in, they like get halfway in and then they'll bend over and you're like, oh. So you need to, fixed it. That'll hold. Yeah. But it's, you need to keep practicing that tool as well. So you, with that tool, so you do get good at it. So it's like, some days I have an absolute shocker when I try and do that stuff. I'm just like, oh. No. And other days I would come back from the walk and it's just like, oh, that was epic. I live in an amazing piece of the world.
Oh, dude, you're so right. Yeah, I think that's absolutely the skill I need to. Yeah, you're right. We when we get older, we sacrifice novelty for routine and habit. You know, that's something that I love watching the dogs, you know, kind of discern, you know, because their world is just, they live in this fucking crazy psychedelic trip right now. Everything is crazy and novel. And that's
is that because you feed them stuff?
That is true. Muffins, of the psychedelic variety. But no, like they're in that universe. And that's obviously why they're, you know, simultaneously so dependent, because they can't make sense of anything. And he just runs across the road and everything's crazy and wonderful. And, you know, and I thought about this for a while, man. I think, you know, self-development and individuality is so much about coming back to that childlike sense of wonder that we lose necessarily as we start to socialize and learn things that we can, you know, eventually habitualize to. And I think it's an inevitable stage of human development, going back and reclaiming the child that was lost when we started to learn about what a tree was and things like that. But you're totally right, man. I think walking the big fella, Mr. Grandpa Jones over there with the big chops, I think you're right. I think you're totally right.
Yeah, and I think, like, it's an important thing to be able to not to have to tax our mental processing so much by recognizing that everything's different, so that we just don't get super overloaded. But I think we probably go too far the other way, and then actually it's a good skill to retrain and to look at kind of where can I get a little bit of wonder back in my life.
Have you noticed that with having Connor? Like, what's that like seeing? Yeah, talk to me. Fatherhood, man, it would be incredible.
It's it's pretty incredible. Like, he's at the age now where he's doing something new every day or every second day, and you're just like, holy crap, this is amazing. And like, I've talked to my wife about it, that there's such a duality in kids, is that like they've been happening for millennia. So they're the most mundane thing out there. They're like, this is just natural. This happens. But they're also the most incredible thing as well. Like, and I think they're much more incredible when they're yours as well. Like, everyone thinks their child's incredible, and they're everyone else is like, oh yeah, they're good. But I think it's like just watching something, especially like Connor, because he was born so early, and I don't know if I've even told people on the podcast that he was born at, born at 26 and a half weeks gestation. So we had almost 100 days in hospital with him. So he weighed about a kg when he was born. Typical baby, I think, is somewhere between 3 and 4 or 3 and 5, depending. So he was a pretty little guy. And then just thinking something from that size, that small, like he couldn't even breathe on his own when he was born. Like, he needed breathing support and things. To go from that and kind of transit through how he's been developing is just incredible, eh? Like, you see the new connections that are happening in his brain. You see the new ability to process emotions and process things as well. And just kind of watching that happen in real time is completely mind blowing, eh? Like, I think it just makes you remember what it is like to have a sense of wonder. Like, I was just watching him the other day as we've got a dog as well. She's a greyhound. We're massive chase reflex, so we can only let her off leash in fenced areas where there are no cats.
same with you and I, mate.
Yeah, unless we want dead cats around. I think actually last time we talked about skinning cats on the podcast. Yeah.
Right, that reminded me.
Yeah, so just get a dog, a fast dog. But like, she was she was running around. She was kind of, it's the dog park we go to is next to a road. She was chasing cars up and down the fence line. And Connor was just, he was off as well. He was kind of running back and forth, like nowhere near as fast as the cars, like the dog was, but just watching him be able to run when a couple of months ago, he only just started walking is it's pretty incredible kind of when you start to look at that. And I think also it, you start to ask yourself like, oh, what's possible as well. It's like you see this such rapid development. And I think as adults, like we don't develop, we can't develop as fast as a child, and we can't learn and pick up things as quickly. But all the science shows us that we can build new skills, build new habits. And you kind of think, actually, why don't I give that a go? Like, why don't I try that? And I think, like, thinking about, like, how do I want to show up as a dad, and how do I want to be as a father? I think I've probably come up with two concepts that are key for me at the moment. Is the first is something that I can't remember where I read it or where I heard it, but it's just the line, my father showed me how to live. And I think that's really important in terms of, like, I can't just tell him what he should be doing. I need to show him. And he's such a sponge at the moment as well. Like, everything you do, he copies. So you've got to watch your swear words around him. Oh my God, what's it? Can you hear that?
Yeah, is that the crowd?
It's the dog. Yeah. Just, what are you doing? Are you all right?
Hunting on the couch. You going all right there?
Just choking on a biscuit. Hang on a second.
Yeah, go for it, mate.
Fox.
Jesus. Sounds like he's, is he all right?
Yeah, she's okay. Sometimes she eats biscuits real fast and just kind of, I think she inhales them. Yeah. And they get kind of stuck in her lungs, so she needs to just hock them back up and swallow them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Dude, I've got a dog that's going crazy at the moment too. I've got a fever.
Are you
what are you working on at the moment? Have you got any projects coming up?
Yeah, so I mean, I've been working on been working on a little bit of this stuff in regards to trying to bring people back out of overwhelm, more from a team perspective, and how do we operate as leaders to help our teams through tough times and kind of modulate the load that we're putting them under, and start to understand also kind of the contextual loads as well from outside of like that team environment, like what is life putting on people. So doing some workshops, doing a little bit of coaching with teams around that, which has been a lot of fun. It's all been virtual. At some point, it might go to kind of in person stuff, which will be cool. But actually, like, the virtual environment doing that is quite cool as well. What else have I been working on? That's probably the big thing. Trying to get the team that I run through this lockdown period safe and sound, and kind of keep us going and keep us productive from a business perspective as well, which has been a fascinating challenge. And like, it's been really good that I started thinking about doing a lot of thinking about this overwhelm stuff beforehand. Yeah, so I've been massively applied it to the work that I do there. And probably the other big project is that we've got number two due in a few months' time. So
yeah, I didn't know that. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty cool as well. So that'll be that's another big project.
Oh my God. That is incredible. And do you know the sex?
Yeah, we're having another boy.
Little Tommy.
Yeah. Tommy. Yeah, yeah. My Tommy, actually. Yeah, we're throwing around names at the moment.
Yeah. Well, man, yeah. Look, if you name him after this big penis head, then I'll give him a rap on the socials.
Oh, nice. Yeah, yeah. Give him a shout out. Yeah.
Yeah.
What about you, bro? What?
Mate, got, you know, where my other half's meditation teacher, so it's been really fun just to kind of, you know, work with her and, you know, I have a couple of little programs that I offer clients and things aside from just, you know, normal counselling. So we throw in a bit of breath work there and, you know, that's really good for trauma release, which is really cool. But, mate, there's two big things that I really am focusing on right now. It's the podcast and it's the books. I want to get the Yes, I'm Fine series. Love to have them all out published, audiobooks, by the end of the year. It's a big goal because I've got to get this draft done. I want to go back and write a second edition preface for my first book and just fix that up a little bit. I'm 35,000 words into book number 3, so I need to complete the full manuscript of that one before I go back and edit it, and then actually have to move through the publishing process and work with the editor and all that sort of stuff. So the editor being my dad, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to ask, is he editing these ones too?
He is editing these ones, yes, yes. So so that's really lucky. But, yeah, but I'd love to have all those out by the end of the year. So that's just my main focus, I suppose.
Yeah, awesome, bro. Awesome. That is very cool. We probably probably should let you go and have some dinner, mate, and should probably go and tuck myself in for some beauty sleep. But it's always
tuck yourself in. You probably get 2 hours a night at the moment, wouldn't you?
Oh, no, he's not too bad. He's not too bad. A couple of times a week he wakes up at about 5. Which is a little bit niggly, but the rest of the time you'll sleep through till about 6. So, mate, if you want to train yourself to get up early, have a baby.
I'll do it. You know, I'll do it now.
Yeah,
I'll have
good.
One tomorrow.
All right, good, good. Very sort of Danny DeVito, Arnold Schwarzenegger.
That's right. It's a skill. Millennium.
Yeah, you can. Just get those neural connections going. The tools that you use.
Exactly.
Oh, buddy, it's been awesome. Let's make sure it's shorter turnaround time than 14 months next time.
Mate, I would like to – I think we could probably do round 4 at least by September, October. You know, you'd have child number 2, little Tommy, and I'd hopefully have the books out by then so we could rendezvous.
Yeah, nice. That sounds good, mate. That sounds good. Let's pencil it in.
Done.
Awesome, bro. You have a good one.